Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't
you know. Yeah, baby. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams with Pete Seeger and David Byrd singing the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness theme song. We have a great show today. Two spectacular guests talking to us from Bolinas, California, the best hidden of all our towns in America. Bolinas is famous for, excuse me, for tearing down their street signs. So not their street sign, but the highway sign that would otherwise guide people into Bolinas. But they take it down, and they are hidden away. Jim and Mary Beth, Jim Haddell and Mary Beth Brannigan, are the principals of the EON Environmental. Jim, Mary Beth, are you on with us?
We are.
Okay. Tell us about EON. You're talking to us from scenic Bolinas, California. We're going to talk about the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. You have been on a magical mystery tour of California these past week or so, tracking opposition to Diablo Canyon. You've been involved in it for decades and decades. But tell us what you do. Tell us first about EON and the nature of your operation.
Well, EON stands for the Ecological Options Network, and people can find out more about it at eon3.net. We also have an extensive YouTube channel, well-subscribed and thriving, and they can find that on YouTube at eon3. That's E-O-N and the number 3. But what we do is to document problem solving in relation to the survival challenges that confront our generation, and we have focused most recently on nuclear issues, on electromagnetic pollution issues, and also on election integrity, which is one of your sidelines.
And you make documentary films. How long have you been making documentary films?
Well, working together since 82, when we made Strategic Trust, the Making of Nuclear-Free Palau for PBS.
Yeah, tell us about that. You made a documentary film about the situation of involving nuclear testing and radioactive fallout from the South Pacific island of Palau. And my understanding was and correct me if I'm wrong, that it was extremely successful. You won a great number of awards and got some good financial support. And then the powers that be cracked down. Can you tell us about all that?
Yeah, well, Mary Beth, I'll just give the headlines and you can fill in the details. But we made it for PB on a Corporation for Public Broadcasting grant, and it was broadcast on PBS, also shown in Congress and at the UN and in parliaments and libraries around the world. It was very successful in that sense and won prizes and festivals and so on. And as soon as, just immediately after that, we were encouraged by the staff at the CPB to just give them something, as they said, on the back of an envelope, and we'll fund your next project. But the Reagan administration went on attack mode and blacklisted us as, what did they call us? Anti-American ideologues.
Disaffected ideologues.
Disaffected
ideologues. You know, that sounds like a great button that I'd
like
to wear.
I think I might get a T-shirt with
I'm
that
a disaffected
on it.
Ideologue.
But anyway, they sent letters around to the PBS stations and to funding agencies and said that we shouldn't be allowed to use public money or private money, for that matter, to make anti-American propaganda. And so overnight, we were persona non grata. But we did find other ways of funding our work, and we've been doing it ever since.
Yeah, what year was that? That was in the 80s, right?
Right.
That was 83.
84, I believe, is when it actually was released and broadcast nationally. And when we took it to Congress and to make it an issue of the subject that we were covering, because and people said, "Oh, you don't have a chance," but we did, and actually, together with other folks that we were working with, which set the pattern for the next 30 years, we worked with other organizations who were responding to the survival challenge, as Jim put it, and we wanted to uphold this tiny island nation's right to have a nuclear-free constitution, because if they didn't have the right, none of us would have the right. And that's exactly the way the U.S. State Department, Defense Department, and Interior Department looked at it as well. They figured if they gave Palau that right, that everybody would want it. And they could. They said that they had to stop it. And during that time, actually, we had a chance to interview some of the original members of the CIA and their its predecessor, what morphed into the CIA, which was what was it called?
OSS.
OSS. The Office of Secret Service.
Right.
And while we were up there in the penthouse interviewing this person, Ray Klein.
You were interviewing Ray Klein?
Right.
He's a legend. Shall we say.
Say that again?
Ray Klein is a legend in the Secret Service world.
Yeah.
We since learned
It's amazing you interviewed him and lived.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Let me tell you what happened. I went down the hall to use the phone, and in that office, there was a sketch of the map of the Pacific, and beautiful calligraphy, hand done. And then next to it was a handwritten sign in the same calligraphy: oppose the will of the people, impose your will on the people, never let the people win a single fight.
Oh, my God. You should have taken a picture of that.
Well, that was before cell phones. That was way before. That was before fax machines.
But I think
you got to write that up and send that to me. That's a hell of a slogan.
Really?
I think we should put that out there. Where was this office?
Oh, right above Henry Kissinger's. Yeah.
So when you read it, did you read it in the original German?
Well, this to give a bit of context, this was back in the 80s, in the time when the nuclear free and independent Pacific movement was really thriving. New Zealand had followed Palau's lead. Palau was the first country in history to pass a nuclear free national constitution, and because they were part of the UN trusteeship system under the U.S., which had taken it over in the war.
From Japan.
From Japan, who had taken it away from Germany.
Who had taken it away
from
Spain.
Spain, right. But they were stimulated, the local people, by this, all the propaganda about democratic choice and government. And so they voted over 90% in favor of the world's first nuclear constitution.
Nuclear-free
constitution.
And green, actually.
We have a nuclear constitution.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
And so the Defense Department wanted to build a submarine base there because it's very close.
Yeah, a nuclear submarine.
Blast the reef open and have deep channels so the nuclear submarines could come and go unseen.
This is on this little island in the middle of the Pacific.
Well, the whole of Micronesia is about the size of the continental United States. So, if Bikini Atoll, where they tested the nuclear bombs, would be New York, then Palau would be San Francisco. So, and it's very close to the Asian mainland. And
in terms of the distance separating them,
yeah,
right. But there's nothing in between. There's just a lot of water in between.
You know, very few islands, you know, there's a couple of little island nations, so that's been it.
Right.
So after you made this film about Palau, you were blacklisted essentially, and you've had to scramble ever since to get funding to do your documentary films, right?
Yeah, we actually kept at it, and we worked with Greenpeace and church groups and other organizations, and we actually went back and forth between Palau, the United States, Palau, New York, and Washington for the next 10 years, made several shorter films, and then...
Wait, mention that what we were doing was going to Congress and to the UN and then back to Palau and using family therapy techniques. Jim had become a psychotherapist, and so that was the idea. We were going to apply family therapy here on an international level.
To the CIA?
No, Congress.
my model was that the United States was the abusive father, the UN was the collusive mother, and Palau was the abused child. And so the idea being if you could increase mutual awareness all around the triangle, you would intervene. And also, you know, it's kind of the Heisenberg indeterminacy principle applied to documentary filmmaking or social intervention. It's as soon as you introduce an observer into a situation, you change the situation.
And actually, I want to make an important note here. It's not that the Palauans were childlike. It's just that in the model of family therapy, they were the abused entity.
Yeah, the identified patient.
Yeah, their culture is thousands of years old and very, very shrewd and wily.
And matriarchal, by the way.
Right, matriarchal.
As they've been governing themselves quite successfully since before Washington was a swamp, you know, so the idea of imposing democracy on them is ludicrous. But one more point to make about that. The United States kept forcing them to re-vote on their nuclear-free constitution 10 times. They never...
Because our government, the United States government, made the Palauans keep voting until they decided to accept nuclear weapons. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, no, they did was to just say that they to drop that nuclear-free clause from the Constitution. But, go ahead, Jim.
Well, because the United States Navy and Armed Forces, of course, don't neither confirm nor deny the presence of nuclear weapons on their vessels. So, but anyway, we don't want to get off into the weeds on this, but the point was that this little country became a kind of beacon for the entire nuclear-free and independent Pacific movement, and then by extension, the nuclear-free zone movement, about which we made a film later on. And finally, 10 years later, PBS actually gave us another grant to go back and visit Palau 10 years later, which we did. But then they refused to broadcast it because it was very critical of local power structures. So, goodbye PBS, I think.
Well, so what happened, just to wrap up here, because we're going to move on to nuclear power in Diablo Canyon, but what is the situation now in Palau in terms of their nuclear-free constitution?
Well, it was eventually eroded, but by that time the Cold War was over. The 10 years of delays that we had helped create prevented them from becoming what one person called a nation of prostitutes and shoeshine boys, which would happen if it became a major nuclear naval base.
But see, what happened was in that 10 years of intervention in our small, modest way, the U.S. State Department's attention turned to the Middle East. And now, ironically, it's turning back to the Asia-Pacific, right? The Asia-Pacific pivot. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens there. But our last documentary on Palau also pointed out that they didn't even need to have the military destroy the environment because they
were, capitalism would do it just fine.
Right. They were trying to overdevelop. However, that did not happen. And it's still, I think, considered the top scuba diving destination in the world because it has the most variety of underwater species found in the world. And it's gorgeous. It's like looking underwater is like a jewel box of colorful, incredible corals and fish.
Wonderful. So are you saying that the movement in Palau for a nuclear-free constitution essentially has been successful?
Yeah, I think you could say that.
In terms,
it's not a nuclear base, and that was the main thing.
But not too many years ago, when we were in Hawaii for another reason, at another conference, Moana Nui, a young Palauan man came up to us and said, "Oh, things have really changed since you kept you were keeping an eye on them," because when there isn't the corruption isn't publicized, then people get away with it. So we don't know, but we're hoping that the archive of material that we left will inspire some young people one of these days in Palau to reclaim their heritage and get that nuclear-free clause back in their constitution.
So it was taken out, the nuclear-free...
It was taken out through a out-and-out fraudulent electron process. As we learned later when in 2004 when we began working with you and the Free Press, Bob and Suzanne and Cliff, in Ohio, ground zero of the 2004 theft of the U.S. election, we realized, hey, we saw this pattern of election fraud because of political machinations in Palau first in the 80s.
Amazing. Amazing. We're talking with Jim Heddle and Mary Beth Brangen of the Environmental Options Network in Bolinas, Colorado, California.
Ecological options.
Sometimes it feels like Colorado there, even though we're right next to the ocean. I guess with global warming, that's a possibility. But we've just talked about the amazing work that they did on Palau in the South Pacific. Of course, not something I planned on, but it's a tremendous story. And this is a situation where you, the filmmakers, had a tangible impact on the politics of the situation there. Is that safe to say?
Certainly we didn't. We weren't a major factor, but we were a very significant factor.
And also, we put out newsletters and we organized to bring people to testify at the UN, and we showed the UN video of what was actually happening on the ground in Palau, and also we did that in Congress, and then we showed what was happening in Congress on the ground in Palau, and so that's what the loop that we made. And we worked with the American Friends Service Committee, and we worked with the United Methodists, we worked with Greenpeace, we worked with a lot of organizations that were also trying to uphold their right for that nuclear-free constitution. One time I counted there were 33 of us globally that were working on it, but we were able to move through larger organizations, and that worked.
Well, fantastic. Good for you. I'm very proud. And, of course, I've known you, God knows, forever. So you are now focused, Jim and Mary Beth Brangen of the Environmental Options Network.
You are
focusing on nuclear power in the United States.
Yes, and particularly in California. But you can't ignore Indian Point and all the other time bombs ticking away.
Right. So tell us now, you're a couple hundred miles north of Diablo Canyon, the two reactors at San Luis Obispo, California. But you just attended this weekend the Democratic Party. Well, tell us what it was. You went to Anaheim near Disney World, Disneyland, and attended a major Democratic Party gathering. And there's a helicopter flying over here. I am in Los Angeles, home of the hovering helicopters. You attended a party meeting, and there was a resolution about Diablo Canyon, which I think people all around the country should be aware of. Tell us what went on, please.
Yeah, well, I think just to give a bit of context, we're producing a documentary about the shutdown of nuclear power in California, hopefully. And its relation to Fukushima and so on. And in fact, you know, a documentary film in which you are emerging as one of the characters, Harvey, I might say.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, we were on a shooting trip documenting current events that are unfolding. And I guess, do you want to take it in reverse order, or do you want to take it in chronological order? Because we started out San Luis Obispo, meeting with one of our friends that is a spokesperson for Mothers for Peace. And then we went to Malibu, California, where you led a meeting informing activists and interested people about some of the issues involved in Diablo Canyon. And then we went south to interview two lawyers in San Diego that are pushing for the revelation of corruption at the California Public Utilities Commission. And then
in relation to
nuclear power in San Onofre and Diablo Canyon. And then we went to a Coastal Commission meeting at which Donna Gilmore, a major mover in the nuclear waste safety movement, spoke.
Give us the culmination. What you over the weekend you were at a Democratic Party convention
I'll tell you about that. They passed a resolution requiring cooling towers at Diablo. And this is the once through cooling issue, and that's what other plants are facing all over the country, isn't it?
Yes. Diablo Canyon water issue is being somewhat duplicated at Indian Point, and also has been a factor in the alleged upcoming shutdown of the reactor at Oyster Creek, New Jersey. And this is because the water quality coming out, the water temperature coming out of the nuclear plants is too hot and is killing billions of marine creatures. And now you we've been trying, the anti-nuclear movement has been trying to get the Democratic Party of California to force cooling towers to be built at Diablo Canyon. So what are you going to tell us about that and the Democratic Party convention there?
Well, it was passed by the Environmental Caucus, the resolution that would require those cooling towers to be placed at Diablo Canyon. And, I mean, this is a resolution you would think that would be a slam dunk, because it's just asking for the state law to be implemented. And this resolution is now being reviewed by the California Democratic Party's Resolution Committee, and there's a good chance that it will be approved by the California Democratic Party in August when they have their final resolution votes. And so it's now going to be moved around to the various Democratic clubs in the state, and that's a major movement forward. So what that resolution says is it's just asking for the cooling towers to be built to replace that once through cooling system in order to meet the state's marine protection standards. So,
let me just give an example of what this is real quickly. It's an antiquated cooling system that they have there, which wouldn't be built now. And it draws an estimated 2.5 billion, that's B with a billion gallons.
Billion with a B.
water every day, and discharges the water back into the ocean by about 20 degrees hotter. And that, of course, has an impact. But in the course of the in-and-out flow, it's estimated that annually the reactor's cooling system sucks in more than a billion fish in early life stages, most of which die. And then about 700 pounds of adult fish are destroyed every year. So this is a major mass destruction of local marine life.
I can't have 700 pounds only? I can't believe that. I bet it's more. Anyway, the good old Diablo Canyon has been stopped a couple of times now by these little sea creatures called salps, S-A-L-P-H, I think it's spelled. And they're like jellyfish, and they're producing like crazy, reproducing because of the changing pH in the ocean. But that's been good for clogging up their water intake and shutting down the reactors.
It's called self-absorption.
Right. So what do you think the political implications would be if the Democratic Party of California actually endorses this move to force Diablo Canyon to put in cooling towers?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting. And just as with the fracking issue here in California, it would line us all up against the Democratic governor, who is not particularly enthusiastic about shutting down Diablo, hasn't said anything.
Well, but what would happen, no doubt, is that if cooling towers are mandated to be built, then the cost of that would have to be passed on to the ratepayers in California. And that decision would have to be approved by the California Public Utilities Commission, which is in the midst of a firestorm of corruption charges. So it's a very complicated situation. But the idea is that if they didn't get approved to let the ratepayers pay for the cost of the cooling towers, then PG&E would throw in the towel and close the plant.
Well, are we sure of that? Now, there is an argument
that's theory. That's a speculative theory.
There's an argument that says that if, in fact, PG&E is forced to pay for the cooling towers, they'll just pass the costs on to the ratepayers.
Yeah.
Very, very
but
possible.
If they can, but that would have to be approved by the
CPUC.
By the CPUC, which is under
The California Public Utilities Commission.
Right, yeah. Right. And the California Public Utilities Commission, as well as PG&E, the corporate owner of Diablo Canyon, are both under severe accusations of corruption. In fact, PG&E, again, the owner of Diablo Canyon, has been indicted with, 38 federal criminal
felony charges.
And
in the case of the San Bruno gas explosion.
So we always say, why should this corporation that has been charged with 38 felony criminal negligent charges, in the case of the explosion with a natural gas line, be allowed to run an aging nuclear plant on 13 earthquake faults in a tsunami zone?
Well, why not? I mean, come on. Let's give them a break here. So I think what you need to do is tell us about the San Bruno explosion, because many of our listeners are not from California and don't know what this is, and I think you need to tell us what happened in San Bruno, California, that led to Pacific Gas and Electric being fined $1.4 billion and being facing all sorts of federal indictments and also state legal proceedings. Tell us what happened in San Bruno.
Well, PG&E, right from its very get-go back in 1906, has been implicated in criminal behavior, corporate criminality. They were part of the reason why there was such a city-destroying fire in San Francisco in the 2006 earthquake. And in this case...
I mean, not 1906.
1906, yeah. And in this case, in San Bruno...
2010?
Pardon?
I think it was...
Yes, it was in 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And their lack of applying budgeted money to maintenance activities for this aging pipeline led to a major explosion. It destroyed a whole neighborhood in San Bruno, California, killed, I believe, 8 people, and flattened the homes, you know, around the explosion. And all of that has turned out to be a man-made disaster by PG&E's historical pattern of maintenance negligence. So it really makes you wonder, why should a corporation with this kind of history and pattern and culture be running an aging nuclear plant?
Right before that happened, that explosion in San Bruno, I was speaking with a lawyer who had just filed a lawsuit on behalf of a client who had been a PG&E gas pipeline inspection manager, and who, after he insisted on taking pictures of problems and passing it up his line of bosses, they were so upset with him that they... PG&E employees took him to a hotel, took away his car keys and moved his car, kept him in the hotel for 3 days while they threatened him.
What?
And, yeah, and that happened. He filed that suit maybe 10 days before San Bruno exploded.
So this is a guy working for PG&E. He basically becomes a whistleblower. He raises issues with the safety of the pipeline at PG&E. They lock him in a hotel room,
right,
and threaten him.
Right. That's what happened.
And then, and did they fire him? What did they do to the guy?
You know, I don't know what happened to that person. I would love to know.
But, you know, PG&E is a huge utility in California, perhaps the largest in California.
Oh, it is.
And, yeah, I think it's the largest in the country, actually.
Yeah, and it also has, you know, national and even international affiliations. So it's a huge conglomerate and traditionally has led the fight by utilities against any kind of public anything. You know, power, water, municipal energy systems, the whole thing. Right from the get-go, back into the 20s, they had a playbook that involved, you know, making strategic donations to local charities and institutions and taking over the newspapers and the banks. And so
is that the 1820s or 1920s? Sorry.
1920s.
Okay, so PG&E is an evil player. We know that. They're extremely powerful. And they have, and now after having locked up and abused their whistleblower, they shortly thereafter there was an explosion, exactly what the whistleblower was warning about.
Right.
And has anybody from PG&E been indicted? Is anybody from PG&E facing jail time for blowing up San Bruno and killing 8 people?
The guys that were in charge at that time got golden parachutes and have moved on to, you know, some other nefarious activity.
But I also want to point out another just amazing fact, and that is Ground Zero was the home of this explosion, was the home of a California Public Utilities Commission staff person who was focused on pipeline safety. Did you know that?
And what happened to him?
She and one of her daughters were killed.
Oh, God.
It's total coincidence, of course, but there you are.
Isn't that ironic?
Jeez.
Or suspicious?
Okay, so here we have Pacific Gas and Electric, one of the largest utility companies in the world. They are running the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant, two 1,100 or thereabouts megawatt reactors at San Luis Obispo, California. They are in violation of federal and state water quality acts.
Yeah, but not only that. They're out of compliance with fire regulations and also, more significantly, with seismic requirements. They're fudging data on their seismic capacity to withstand tsunamis or earthquakes, or mainly ground motion. And they're an on-site NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission investigator.
Senior inspector.
Senior inspector had recommended in a report that they be closed down until seismic security could be assured, because they're the new discoveries about the seismic vulnerabilities of the region, 13 intersecting, connecting earthquake faults under the plant, which weren't known about at the time the plant was designed. And so ground motion potential is far beyond the design parameters of the plant. So he reported that. NRC overruled him and said, no, it's not a problem, and transferred him to some obscure job in Tennessee.
Right.
But
if it was in Russia, he'd be in Chelyabinsk. But so they sent him to Chattanooga instead.
Right.
And meanwhile, the situation with the cooling system and with the seismic system and with the fire protection systems at Diablo Canyon are unabated. Let's put it that way.
Right. And most people don't know that. It doesn't get out in much publicity, or, you know, people just don't understand. San Onofre was so fortunate in that it was clearer that it was broken. In the case of Diablo Canyon, San Onofre being the other still operating nuclear reactor site in California that had to be shut down because of a radiation leak from a failed steam generators.
All right, just to update, and we have had shows about this, but so the anti-nuclear movement has successfully forced the shutdown of the two reactors at San Onofre. Mazel tov to everybody. It's a wonderful thing,
and
thank goodness that San Onofre is shut.
And it was a blessing that it had that first radiation leak that was enough to cause it to be shut down initially, so that then all of the broken nature of their steam generator could be studied and come out in public. Whereas in Diablo Canyon's case, it appears to be okay. And that's the problem. I think we need to get more people aware.
It appears to the public to be okay.
Right.
Not to the senior on-site NRC inspector.
And not to the people who are working on this and focused on it. So that's why we're so grateful, Harvey, that you are speaking out about this all over the place. So.
And another dimension to this is that PG&E is the major employer in San Luis Obispo County, and uses its old playbook of contributing generously to local charities and institutions. So not only is there the threat of them closing the plant used to say, oh, jobs will evaporate, and the economy of the whole region will be impacted, and so on. So it's a very difficult situation with lots of forces aligned in the direction of keeping the plant going, even though it's out of compliance with so many regulations.
It's also out of sight. You can't see it. And that also helps, because in making it out of sight, out of mind. But anyway, there is a whole bunch of people now that are focused on bringing all these different facts out, and we feel like this can be a perfect storm between the seismic issues, the fire issues, and the once-through cooling issues.
And part of the story we're telling in this documentary Shutdown that we're in the process of making is the really important impact that citizen action has in these kinds of fights. Encouraged by the local success in shutting down San Onofre with some help from Friends of the Earth, a Washington-based group, the nuclear-free California movement is kind of going through a rebirth and a resurgence, and you were a part of that right in the beginning, and now it's really gratifying to see some of the gray heads coming back, as well as some young people picking up the banners. And the aim is, the best-case scenario would be to close down Diablo and then institute a really responsible way of managing the accumulated tons of wastes in these two locations, which have nowhere to go and are now being stored in highly corrosive, seismically dangerous, tsunami-prone environments on the coast of California.
So shocking.
Let
me interrupt here. We're talking with Jim Heddle and Mary Beth Brangen. They are filmmakers, and they have the Environmental Options Network in Bolinas, California, and they have dedicated the last decades of their lives to making documentary films about environmental issues, starting with the nuclear situation in Palau, but now dealing first with San Onofre, the two reactors shut in Southern California, and now the two at San Luis Obispo, Diablo Canyon, in Central California along the coast. So we only have, we're down to the last 18 minutes or so. What is the prognosis for shutting Diablo Canyon, and where does renewable energy fit into this?
Oh, I was just going to bring up the fact that the California Independent Systems Operator, the people that run the grid in the state, have even admitted that we don't need the energy from Diablo Canyon. If Diablo Canyon were shut tomorrow, it would the grid would completely be fine. It's in fact that right now it's estimated that we have 40% excess energy produced in California, and there are so many renewables that we can access that aren't even counted in that assessment. So we have to break through this thinking that it has to be there for some to keep the lights on. That is totally untrue.
Or that nuclear energy is a solution to climate change, which
utter nonsense,
yeah,
as we all know.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
But,
sorry.
As far as the transition of California to renewables goes, there's tremendous economic pressure in that direction, and the utilities, of course, not only in California but across the country, are resisting that, saying this will destroy our business model, which no doubt will, you know. So they're fighting for their lives. They're like cornered rats. The whole monopoly utility company licensed to exploit the resources and the ratepayers of a given utility district is coming to its end.
Just today I read in an industry online journal that the majority, though, of CEOs of utility executives in the U.S. are now saying that they're going, that they are changing their business model. It's like 51% are 51 or 53% are seeing the handwriting on the wall and starting the process of changing their business model to allow for their businesses to become decentralized and working in cooperation with distributed energy sources. So that's really major news.
But then not the heads of PG&E and or Southern California isn't done any choice anymore.
Not yet with them.
San Onofre is gone.
Mm-mm. Right. What was the other question that you had?
Well, what is the role now that renewables is playing in all this? You are tracking also with your documentary films on California the rise of the renewable energy industry. And this is really a huge deal. I mean, California has enormous renewable resources, and we're seeing in Germany now that they're able to being very successfully transiting to renewable energy. How is this playing out with the rise of an industry in California?
Well, there's a lot of positive developments, and there's also some developments that are a bit troubling, because if you apply the same business model of monopoly centralized ownership of, like, for example, solar facilities, you get the people who caused the problem using the same strategies to try and solve the problem,
the same consciousness.
With the same consciousness that they created the problem. But that aside, I mean, we've come down to, it's a question of scale, ownership, location, and finally, who gets the power that's generated by these facilities? If they're privately owned, centrally controlled, and the power goes out of state or some far distant location, then that's a very different model than the local microgrid, publicly owned, regional or local power, mini power grid. And that's the model that more and more folks are moving toward, and it's also the model that utilities are trying to resist.
The microgrids are just more able to be environmentally sensitive and non-damaging, and that's what we're talking about, the huge...
Well, tell me, what is a microgrid? Explain to us what a microgrid actually is.
Microgrids can range from a single building to neighborhood to, maybe even a shopping mall, a huge one. You can have your own power within that area, and it can be, it could be put onto a larger grid for, as they call it, the backbone, to supplement in case that's required. But the technology is there now to allow people to generate their own energy on site, and when it's done like that, you don't waste the energy that's produced in transmission, and you don't pollute and destroy the environment because you have to build these huge and polluting transmission lines. So,
or solar arrays that destroy, pristine habitat because you're using the roofs of the houses and the business buildings for solar generation.
Lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's the point that we're making, because even in the case of renewables, if they're not done right, they can be damaging. But it's not necessary to do them in a damaging way. And it's far more efficient and healthy in the long run to put them closer to where you need the energy.
There's a guy, you probably know a lot about this, Harvey. There's a guy named Mark Jacobson, a Stanford scientist, that he and his colleagues have unveiled like a 50-state plan to move to renewable energy. And there's, I guess they have one also for California. And the real impediments to all of this is the political will. There's not any technological problems to overcome. And so that's the real promise of it. As the failing economy and the failing monopoly energy models continue to collapse and fade away, fighting all the way, these new approaches to energy generation and distribution will inevitably take hold. So I hope I'm not being mindlessly optimistic, but I think that's what's going on.
My understanding is that there's a California, the Chumash tribe in California has actually implemented a microgrid for part of their community, which has made them completely independent of the grid.
Oh, that's great. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I can confirm that from personal knowledge.
Well,
they have a casino, and I think the microgrid may involve the casino. I'm not sure, but we're speaking with Jim Heddle and Mary Beth Brangen of the Environmental Options Network. Unfortunately, we're coming into the end of the hour. They are based in Bolinas, California, and have been very instrumental in some really great stuff with renewables and with the movement to shut Diablo Canyon.
Also, community choice aggregation, which is like public power light, is really spreading throughout California. People are working hard to get away from the utility model and purchase their own energy on the open market, which is also forcing the utilities to turn and offer more renewable sources.
Good. That's a big deal. And, of course, in California. Of course, one of the high points of our entire movement came, it's a few months ago now, there was a guy on Fox, one of their commentators, and they were talking about Germany having gone to 100% or on their way to 100% renewables. And the guy, I couldn't make this up, the guy on Fox said that it was a lot easier for Germany to go to renewables than the United States because Germany had a lot more sunshine than the United States.
Yeah.
You know, where do they get these guys? But we are in I am in Los Angeles. You guys are in Northern California. We're in the heart of the solartopian movement to a green-powered Earth, and California is leading the way, and hopefully will lead the way with the shutdown of Diablo Canyon.
Harvey, do we have a minute to put in a plug for the safest possible storage of the radioactive waste that we've got to deal with?
Yes, very quickly, because I know Donna Gilmore has been involved with this, and you've done this, and this is at the tail end of things. We are facing the reality of massive quantities of radioactive waste at reactors that are shutting down, including the San Onofre reactors, and the activists in Southern California are extremely focused on seeing at least some kind of dry cast storage that will last more than 20 minutes. So why don't you tell us about this? We have about 5 minutes left.
Well, the problem is just enormous in volume. We've got the equivalent of multiple Chernobyl's worth of radioactive waste on every site that we have in the state where the radioactive waste is left from formerly operating nuclear plants in Humboldt and in Rancho Seco and then now San, which are shut down, thank goodness, but then and San Onofre and now Diablo Canyon, which is still producing it. The calculations are still being done by Donna and Linda Seeley, but it's approximately a Chernobyl's worth in every canister. So what, or every two canisters. So what has to happen, because this is has been heretofore been put into thin half-inch or stainless steel cask, or maybe 6.6 inches thick, where Germany, Japan, other nuclearized countries have put the waste in casks that are approximately 20 inches thick, and with double lids that you can monitor, and which would give warnings if a leak occurred. Right now, you can't tell whether there's a crack or a leak happening in any of these poorly designed containers, thin cans, for the waste here in California. So part of the big push right now, in addition to shutting down Diablo, is to make sure that the utilities don't get away with buying the cheapest possible system and then maybe having it leak within another 8 to 20 years.
People can find out more about this in detail by going to Donna's excellent site, which is sanonofresafety.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I would invite people to visit one of our blogs, which is called planetarianperspectives.net, and our website is eon3.net.
That's eon3.net. This is Jim and Mary Beth, my buddies from Bolinas, California. How are things in Bolinas? I bet they're beautiful.
Absolutely.
They are indeed. But I want to give one more plug, and that's for
Please.
Our documentary, our upcoming documentary.
Very quickly. We're down to our last 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, people can see a preview of what we're doing at our website, which is shutdowndoc, that's D-O-C, shutdowndoc.tv.
And what is the website of the California anti-nuclear group that you set up?
It's called
No Nukes. CA for California.net.
No nukes, CA.net.
Right.
Well, Jim and Mary Beth, you've been great. Real quickly, anything else you want to throw in here as we move ahead?
We appreciate your having us on, and there's lots more to talk about, but it's been a pleasure to be with you.
It's it's amazing how fast an hour flies by when you have great guests. This has been Jim Heddle and Mary Beth Brangen of the Environmental Options Network, eon3.net. Org?
It's Ecological Options Network at eon3.net.
Eon3.net. Their films are fantastic. We actually made one on my cycles of history theory, and also you recorded an interview with me with Ernest Callenblack, which we will play at a future date, and which is available through your website. Thank you guys so much. You've been a tremendous asset to the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks to the crew in New York. And we're going to roll on out here with Pete Seeger, Dar Williams, and David Burns. We'll be back to you next week with another fantastic hour at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Thanks.
No.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.